song is called The Tiger Rag. Nobody knows who wrote it. According to Nick LaRocca, Nick LaRocca wrote it. Jelly Roll Morton says it was Jelly Roll Morton. According to Punch Miller, he and Jack Carey wrote the Hold That Tiger part. What matters here is it's a song that Lee liked to play on the piano. This is Shelley, one of Lee Turner's daughters. Coming up will be an interview that Lee did with his lifelong friend Dean Porter and his daughter, who's also named Shelley, back in the year 2000, where they're reminiscing about courtroom battles. After Lee and Betsy got married in the early 1950s, they moved to the small town of Great Bend, Kansas, so that Lee could practice law with his uncle, Tudor Hampton. Here's how it began.
Sidney Graubart. I think about the third case I tried. I was trying all the garbage cases that Hampton had. Sidney Graubart was Jewish, and he was from St. Louis. Before that, from New York City. He was a traveling salesman. And he had had a horrible wreck outside of Rush Center, Kansas. And a poor lady named Farm Lady, named Trilby Weltmer, had been involved in an accident with him, and she had a very badly misshapen leg over it and other serious injuries. But I'll never forget Sidney as my client in the first case. We're trying it at La Crosse, Kansas. Sidney shows up in a blue suede shoes, a 10-carat diamond, and I mean, he was something to see. Now, here he is testifying. Remember, this is a local lady, farm lady, you know, small county. He says, get the picture. He says, I'm driving west on K-96 highway in my new Olds 98 sedan with air conditioning. This is 1952. He says, when all of a sudden he says, I see a car coming from the opposite direction, headed my way, driven by that. And he points to Trilby Weltmer. He says, she stops. She lets one car go by. She lets another car. I assume she sees me and is going to let me go by. And he says, I go back down on the accelerator. He says, I'm traveling maybe 85, 90 miles an hour. When all of a sudden, when she's 186 and 6-tenths feet away from me, he says, she commences a left turn. He says, we hit. On the first roll, he says, the windshield went out. On the second roll, something else went out. On the third roll, he says, I went out. He says, and I was rolling. All of a sudden, he says, I hear a splash nearby. I say to myself, Jesus Christ, Graubart, there's no water around here. You're lying in your own blood. I look at the jury, and their mouths are open. They'd never encountered anything like that in their life.
Yeah.
Well, the upshot of it was we had countersued for the damaged Graubard's car and his clothing and so forth. I'll be damned if the jury didn't bring in a verdict in favor of Graubart against Trilby Weltmer. Judge, who was a great judge, went on the bench in 33. But anyway, he told me, he says, I'll enter judgment in your favor, but you've got to drop the judgment you've got against Trilby Weltmer. He says, I just can't sign my name to something like that. Under those circumstances, I always thought that was an interesting case. And when he'd come through the country for 4 or 5 years, he'd stop in and see us in remembrance of that case. Now, you want to know about the first case I tried for State Farm. I had just left Hampton. I was with him for 6 months. And their philosophy, you know, he's my uncle.
Sure.
But their philosophy didn't accord with mine. They drank a lot, they chased women, and so I left. And but I tried a number of cases while I was there, their garbage case, won them all. I started my own practice, and within a month, Phil Clark came by and said that he had a real big problem with State Farm case. The case had been filed over a year ago before. And he had turned it to Russell, Obie, and Foss. And he just found out that they hadn't even bothered to file an answer. And it was a year and a half in default. He said, if you can get the judge to reinstate it and allow you to answer out of time, he says, you could defend it for State Farm. He says, because it's a real serious case. And he says, I'll be in big trouble for letting it go a year and a half without an answer. So I go see the judge. The judge agrees to allow me to file an answer out of time. And incidentally, the people who had filed the lawsuit was Tudor Hampton, who had that firm had formerly represented State Farm. Well, the upshot of it was they never dreamed I'd do this, but I took it to trial and beat them. And that went over well with State Farm. John Allen, you know, was divisional superintendent at that time out of Nebraska. And so the next State Farm case came along, I got the case. And after I had won four or five State Farm cases, pretty soon I'm getting a flood of State Farm cases. And I've always had State Farm as a result. You know that we defended case all over Kansas for State Farm, and occasionally outside of Kansas. But that was the start of my work for State Farm Insurance Company.
Did they keep you pretty busy, State Farm? Did you have outside clients?
Oh, I had a lot. Dean, my first year in private practice, I tried over 30 jury cases. Most of them were drunken driving cases where I defended. Now, we had a county attorney, Bob Southern. In law school, he was affectionately known as Suds. He loved the beer, and he loved to drink. But all field workers, he wanted to throw the book at him as county attorney. If you were from the country club, nothing. I mean, you were never charged with anything, and I thought that was discriminatory and bad. So here came the drunken driving cases, and I think I tried 28 in a row and got 28 defense verdicts. The Tribune was having editorials. What's wrong with our Barton County juries that they're turning loose these drunks and so forth? My first year out of law school, in addition to State Farm, I got Employers Mutual Casualty. And the same thing had happened. Tudor Hampton, who went to school with Hugh Randall in law school.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, he went to law school with him. They had defended Employers, but they had a good case come along against Employers, so they took it. And Hugh Randall hired me to defend it because he had heard about my trial work. And so we tried that case, and I beat him. And pretty soon I've got a flood of Employers cases. And then Farm Bureau comes along. And after my first year, I think the second year, I tried 40-something jury cases. And by the end of the third year, I was up bouncing around 50 jury cases a year. And remember, I did all my own typing?
Yeah, I remember.
128 words a minute, an electric typewriter. And I was never so efficient in my life as I was then. I remember in 4 years out of law school, in 56, I got an audit by the IRS. And instead of having me come to Wichita, they came out to my office. And the reason I got audited was that my income then, net income, was, I think, $80,000 a year, and my expenses were about $15,000 a year, and they couldn't understand how that could be.
How old were your expenses?
About $20,000 a year total. You know, I did all my own work, and they couldn't understand how someone could do that type of thing. And if you recall, that's when it was 90% tax bracket, and it was a killer. On the top end of my income, I was paying 90% taxes.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
But by the end of the, by 1958, I was really knocking down a lot of money. And that's when Betsy started saying, maybe I could help. Maybe I could do something in law practice. And hell, by that time, I had, let's see, Deborah's born in 52, 54, Shelley, or Stephanie, 56. 2, 4, 6. That was Cindy. Yeah, Cindy, and then in 1960 we had Chase. Am I missing one? Deborah, Stephanie, Shelley. That's 56. 58 was Cindy. 2 years apart. But anyway, Betsy was Phi Beta Kappa, you know, in business, and she comes from a family of organizational geniuses. She's smarter than all the other Dillons. But the Dillons wouldn't let her into the organization because she was a woman. And here she had four kids. And the idea she could help me with the practice law, I thought was ridiculous. So I didn't pay much attention to it. And then in 1960, I was awfully busy. She said, we got to hire somebody to do the typing and so forth. You're getting too busy. So we hired Kay Holman. Her husband was superintendent of schools. And she was the youngest of 12 kids. And very smart woman. She worked for us for at least 15 years until
her kids... Was that the start of paralegal?
Yeah. We found to do the work I'd been doing, typing, it took two women to do what I'd been doing. But we hired nothing but very bright women. Kay Holman's husband, as I said, was superintendent of schools. Now, about 1960, she had badgered me about helping. But what she did is went through my closed files. And after about 3 months, she came out and said, you want to see how you practice law? And I said, what? And she says, look. And she lays it out. And all the time I'm doing things because I'm good, I was simply following a pattern. I'd done it so often that I'd memorized it. And I was case to case to case, I had the same approach, case to case. She said, now, we can teach others by establishing standard operating practices. We teach others to do these things and free you to do the creative things that you're so good at. Got to be subtle with men. You can't hit them head on. And so it took me another year. Finally, I decided to go with it. And we started paralegals. And by 1965, we had six non-lawyers for every lawyer. And they were women, doctors' wives, ministers' wives, you name it. But all of them were college graduates, and all of them bright as hell. And that allowed me to do an awful lot more because, you know, it's like the 100 fingers of Mr. T on the piano. And what you do is you have this large group of support people that do a lot of minutiae and a lot of creative things. And in about 1968, the American Bar heard how we were doing and came out and decided to go with the national program, and I was chairman of the national committee that set up all the paralegal programs in the United States.
Lee, do you remember what year was you came to Oklahoma City and talked to the Bar Association about paralegal?
It would have been probably in the 70s.
That's when I took my district down and listened to you.
Yeah, I've probably been in the 70s.
About 1970?
You see, I've spoken in, oh, I would say at least 48 of the 50 states, all over the country, many states, many times, on that subject. And as you know, I've done trial seminars all over the world where you bring in, the organization brings in what they consider the best trial lawyers, and you try mock trials. You usually have an audience of a couple thousand lawyers from all over the country. Yeah, I've done an awful lot of that.
Shelley, you have a question?
Well, what would be next if we were talking about after paralegals and...
well, the interesting thing about trial work is that you are exposed to every situation imaginable. you try a case that may involve chemicals, and you hire the top people in the field. And if they can make me understand the issues involved in a case, I'll make a jury understand. Trial work is the civilized substitute for the shootout in the streets. And instead of shooting it out in the streets, if you've got good lawyers, they're representing to the best of their ability their clients. On the anvil of that clash, you hammer out the truth. Now, if you have a poor lawyer, why, it gets skewed. But through that clash, you establish a solution instead of people going out and killing themselves or going to war and that type of thing. And that's the purpose of trial law. Now, a lot of people say that trial law is bad and we shouldn't have it. We should have the British system or something of the sort. Well, the problem is judges are all over the place. This judge may be an ultra-conservative, this one an ultra-liberal. And so it's the luck of the draw on what's going to happen to you if you have a judge hear a case instead of a jury. Juries, on the other hand, are very homogeneous in the United States. And you can try a case in state after state after state, and your jury looks just like your jury, for example, in Kansas. Same makeup, same approach, same attitudes. You find in the cities, for example, it's somewhat different. For example, you get a Kansas City, Kansas, or inner cities, you may get 10 of your 12 jurors black. But it's a funny thing about blacks. If you approach it right and understand their sensibilities, you can do fine with black juries. They'll try to do the right thing. You can't talk down to them. You can't patronize them. I'm a total believer that juries level things out. And you can, given a given set of facts, you can anticipate what a jury is going to do in returning a verdict. With judges, it all depends on the luck of the draw because they cover the spectrum from ultra-conservative to ultra-liberal. And that's why I'm a total believer in the jury system.
Lee, explain the problem we had with Freddie Wolfslagle, the
okay,
judge.
Okay, Freddie Wolfslagle. Give you a background on Freddie. He was from Lyons, and he had never had a great deal of success as a lawyer. Now, Freddie was bright. But when Roy McMullen died, Freddie went on the bench. Well, I guess he hadn't died. He retired. But Freddie went on the bench in 1958. Freddie was not a trial lawyer. But Freddie immediately set about turning all the lawyers in the district into sycophants. He'd walk in the courtroom, and all the lawyers, he'd look at the lawyers, and they'd all start to smile. trying to gain favor with Freddie. And he encouraged that. Well, that went over with like a lead balloon with me. Now, in the district, I had more trial work than all the other lawyers put together with the multiple added to it. Almost all the trial work, civil trial work, was mine. And we start trying cases. Well, the first case that was tried, Freddie tried, was called McGee versus Livingston. And what had happened, Homer Livingston lived north of town on the Juco Road, okay? The road that ran east and west in front of his house, as you went east, had a yield right-of-way sign. As you come west, it had a yield right-of-way sign. As you come from the south, had a north yield right-of-way sign. In other words, that was the preferential road, except there were no signs whatsoever on Homer as he came out of his township road to go on that road. So he had the right-of-way. Here comes McGee. He sees the yield right-of-way sign. He's driving about 60 miles an hour. Homer hits him. Homer had the right-of-way. And it knocks McGee's car over into the ditch, and he's pinned in the car with his head pinned in about 10 inches of water, and he drowns in that 10 inches of water. So here's the lawsuit, wrongful death. We had the right-of-way. A Safeway truck driver saw this happen on 281 Highway, and he was listed as a witness, and he testified at the time of trial. Now, while he testified, Freddie is looking up at the ceiling smiling, or turned to the jury smiling. And occasionally he'd look at this guy, the witness. The look says, hey, you lying SOB. The jury saw all that. Then, after going through those gyrations, he did some other things that clearly indicated to the jury that he thought all of this was a lie concocted. He cross-examined the Safeway truck driver. Had no right to, but he did. He said, where did they find you? Who was responsible for locating you and bringing you here today? All of which was outrageous. Well, up to that time, let's see, that was in 1968.
19 when?
58. I'm 6 years out of law school. I had never lost a jury trial in my life. jury came back with a verdict for $12,000 for the plaintiff, not much. But one of the jurors was a manager of Dylan's. And immediately he said it really was bad. He says, do you know the first day after the judge made us all think that that witness was a liar, that all of the jury went out to the scene and ran tests at the scene. And one of the guys on the jury was an engineer, and they ran tests. And, of course, all of that's outrageous and improper, and you have a duty to get that evidence and move for a new trial. And there's Kansas City versus public something or other. Well, anyway, I send Phil Clark, who was a lawyer, and he was State Farm's on the case. I send him out to take statements from the jurors as to what happened. About 3 days later, I get a call from Freddie. I understand that you're having someone interview the jury. Yeah, I said, malfeasance on the jury's part, misconduct. He says, I don't allow anybody to talk to jurors. So I said, this is your first time. You're telling me that you've had a practice before the first case you ever tried? Well, he says, you are not to talk to any of the jurors under any circumstance. I said, I have a duty to do it. And I cite him in Supreme Court cases. Clark's taken more statements. Then about 6 days later, I get a call from Freddie, just beside himself. You're violating what I told you. He says, you tell that damn State Farm to pay the judgment and close this, or you're going to be in big trouble. I said, I got a duty to do it. There's misconduct. I said, also what you did, cross-examination of witness so-and-so. I said, I've got to do it. He says, you're asking for big trouble. So here comes the motion for new trial. He ordered all the lawyers in the district to be present in court, and they were. And he comes in with a stack of books about 3 foot high, and they were old English books, no Kansas cases or American cases, in which in England they said that once the jury's verdict is in, it's final regardless. And I'm arguing the motion. He says, are you saying that my examination of witness so-and-so was improper? Are you saying the tone of voice I used was improper? I pick up the transcript, and I riffle through it on my right ear, and I riffle through it on the left ear, and then I riffle through it, and I said, Judge, I'm sorry, I've listened to the transcript. And I said, I can't get anything about the tone of voice coming through, but I remember your tone of voice, and it was outrageous and improper. And I said, as I read the transcript, I said, your actions as trial judge were outrageous and improper. And I said, now, to me, it's immaterial whether I get a new trial here or I get a new trial in the Supreme Court, because one way or the other, I'm going to get one. And I said, from my own standpoint, I'd just soon have you overrule the motion for new trial here so that I can appeal to the Supreme Court and have the Supreme Court review how outrageous and improper your conduct as a trial judge was. And you could hear the lawyers sucking in their breath, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the upshot of it was he waited about 6 months when I was on vacation in Colorado. And you recall that very
well. Yeah.
Dean calls me and he says, you got to come home immediately. I said, why? He says, Freddie Wolfslagle has issued an opinion in which he says that you are destroying the jury system and that what you did was outrageous and unethical and so forth. Well, I come home. Freddie had issued about a 25-page opinion in which he said that my talking to jurors or having them interviewed was destructive of the jury system and was damaging everything that he and his court reporter tried to establish. I understand, it's the first case he ever tried. But he granted a new trial. Now, what Freddie had in mind was by granting a new trial, I'd never get a review of what he had done. Oh, he also called the paper in and had him publish the opinion in the newspaper. That's what Dean had seen. He thought that I'd never get a review. But a friend of mine had just retired from the Kansas Supreme Court. I sent the transcript down to him. He calls me the next day. He said, I stayed up all night reading it. He says, he's outrageous, improper. He says, you've done exactly the right thing. And he says, I'm going to talk to my colleagues on the Supreme Court about this. Well, To top it off, I immediately filed a motion to disqualify Freddie in all of my cases. 70% of his workload in the district were my cases. And I attached his opinion in the proceedings in Livingston McGee by reference. And all of a sudden, Freddie realized that I would get my review sooner or later in the Supreme Court, which just absolutely dumbfounded him. Well, for a while, we hammer and tongs. I never backed off Freddie in my life. Won all the cases. One case, I had to try three times. He set aside the defense verdict, first case. The second case, set aside the defense verdict. Third time, jury came in, same verdict. And so he entered judgment on it, but ordered everybody to never mention that case again. Kinzel something or other. Again, as long as he lived. Well, the upshot of it was that after a while, he began to get worried about the reviews because it was pending. Oh, at the hearing on the motion for new trial to disqualify, ordered all the lawyers in the district to be present again. And they were present. And he ruled that he was not prejudiced against me or my clients. I appealed Supreme Court. Freddie decided he wants to be nice to me for a while. And so for a while he was nice to me. God, it was horrible. Oh, Mr. Lee's here. He's busy. We'll have to take up his matter first because he's awfully busy. It's sickening. Well, anyway, Supreme Court heard it and disqualified him in all of my cases in perpetuity. Now, 70% of his work was my cases. All of a sudden, he had nothing to do. That went on for a couple of years. They had to bring in outside judges to hear the cases. After a couple of years, Freddie came to my office, and he says, if you'll withdraw your disqualification, he says, your clients can get justice in my court. And I said, let me get this straight. You're saying that if I withdraw it, you can start hearing the case again, that my clients can get justice. Yes, yes. I said, understand one thing. I don't want anything other than straight down the middle. I don't want the tipping of the scales one way or the other. I want it straight through. That's what I'll do and so forth. Now, for about the next 3 years, Jesus Christ, I could do no wrong in Freddie's court. The lawyers sit there and fume because Mr. Lee, Mr. Lee, and so forth. Then one day, after about 3 years, he calls me in. He says, Lee, he says, you have a problem. I said, what's the problem? He says, you want to win all the time. He says, other lawyers have to make a living. And he says, you're entitled to win half the time or lose half the time. I said, simple. Tell me when it's my client's turn, time to lose, and I'll tell my clients to get another lawyer because it's not fair to them because it's my time to lose. Well, you're not taking me seriously. I said, well, what you're talking is like an idiot, that somehow people have turns regardless of the facts.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm not going to change the way I do things. The other lawyer better look to what he's doing when we go to trial, because I'm going to beat him if I can beat him. That's my duty to my client. And so pretty soon we get back to hammer and tongs. But we're trying a case in Lyons. Art Hodgson was the lawyer. And this is a case where they'd concealed a bunch of medical evidence, and I'd subpoenaed the doctor when he testified. I had the whole file, proceed to eat him up alive. Then a highway patrolman testified, and he's trying to use a speed calculator, and he doesn't know sick him about what he's doing. Whereupon, Freddie tells the jury, this is what the witness is trying to say. This is what the speed calculator means, blah, blah, blah. The judge. When he finished, I said, please, the court. I move to strike the court's remarks completely from the record and admonish the jury to totally and completely disregard what you just told them. I said, in the first place, the calculator speaks for itself. Number two, you've had no training in interpreting speed calculators. And number three, you don't know what you're talking about because what you just told this jury is wrong and outrageous. Clear the courtroom. No, then he decided to leave the jury there, and he and I were to go into chambers. So we go into chambers. close the door. He says, Lee, let's bury the hatchet. He says, life is too short to keep on doing this. Then he told me the lawyers that had egged him into fighting with me. Yeah. Tudor Hampton's one of them. He named them all. And we go through this deal. We're in there for 2 hours while the jury, everybody's in the courtroom sitting, waiting, jury, go back in and, you know, of course, win the case. But after that, I got fairly decent treatment from Freddie. But the interesting thing is, towards his retirement, he began to tell everybody that would listen what a great pleasure it was to have me as a trial lawyer in his court. Now, you know, by that time, I'd become pretty famous around the United States. And that he's now in a rest home, but he tells everybody that he was the judge who heard many of my cases in his career, and that I was the best trial lawyer that he ever heard in his career on the bench. And it's kind of interesting how things evolve.
Did you become pretty good friends, Lee?
No.
With Freddie?
No.
No, never did.
No, he wanted to be good friends, but I never did. I've always been careful with judges because, number one, it's improper. Jim Logan, for example, just retired from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and Jim's a very close friend of mine. But when he went on the bench, I stopped seeing him. He and his wife were really good friends, and Betsy and I. And Jim is one of the most famous judges in the Circuit Court of Appeals in the United States. It just, to me, is improper.
It was improper.
Because if you're close friends of a judge, you have a tendency, the judge does, to lean in your favor. Yep. And I've had lots of judges that really liked me a lot. We weren't great social friends, but because I wouldn't do that. They start sustaining your objections. Well, if a jury sees the judge sustaining the objections all the time, pretty soon they're going to feel sorry for the other guy.
Yeah.
And so you either stop making objections or you tell a judge, hey, lay off.
Oh, by the way, is Tudor Hampton still alive?
No, he died 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Cirrhosis of the liver.
Shelley, another question?
What's this trial of Otto Weilert?
Otto Weilert.
Weilert.
Well, that's a long story. One of the first cases I tried for State Farm, Otto Weilert was plaintiff. And Weilert versus, I forget the name of our shirt. But Otto had, I won that case, but Otto had 13 kids, lived at Hayes America. They had a furniture store, Weilert's of Hayes. And if you recall, early on TV, they'd bring on their son Larry, Lawrence, and Lawrence was like 9 years old, and he'd speak on one minute commercials, 1,000 words a minute, screaming at the top of his lungs, and you turned it on because it's funny as hell. And here's this kid, you know, screaming like he'd always finish, "Come on, here's Hayes America," and that was the 1 minute commercial. Well, Larry grew up to be about 6'3" and weigh about 240. And had a lot of business up at Hayes Oil and everything. He, in turn, produced about 14 kids. And to give you a flavor of Lawrence Weilert, his daughter sent out a notice to lots of people that Lawrence and Mrs. Weilert announced the forthcoming marriage of their daughter so-and-so to so-and-so. Larry looks at that, calls the paper and takes out a full-page ad in the newspaper. Lawrence and Mrs. Weilert don't announce a goddamn thing. They not only are not approving of this marriage, they are violently opposed to it. See, she was marrying a Protestant, and they were very, very devout Catholics.
Oh, yeah.
And they called the Protestants cheese knifers. And the reason, at Hayes, you know, it's 50-50, Catholic, 50, Protestant. And cheese knifer refers to the Masonic knife, you know, or sword, and the cheese knifers. And they didn't go to the wedding. Now, one of their children was Buster. Buster was bigger than his father. Now, what happened? I get a call one day, and Larry says, Lee, he says, are you available for the next 2 days? And I said, well, I looked at the calendar. Yeah, probably. He says, I'm going to trial tomorrow up at Stockton. And he says, I have decided that I need a lot better lawyer than I have. And he says, I'd like to know if you'd be willing to represent me. I said, it starts tomorrow? It starts tomorrow. I said, tell me what the facts are. He told me. I said, Lawrence, if I go up and try that case for 2 days, it's going to cost you $10,000. Well, he died over the telephone. They're very tight. But finally, he decided that he better have me up there. So we go up to Stockton. Now, beautiful courtroom there. Steve Flood of Hayes, who is very straight-laced, was the judge. The jury, I always work from the end of the jury box so that the witness is looking at the jury as he looks at me. Because you want the jury to see their facial expression and all the rest. Now, here's the story. Lawrence, of course, shows up in court in a suit and so forth. They all agree. Well, what had happened is they had sold a van to a young couple in their late 20s at Stockton. And the people hadn't made any payments on the van, had been involved in small accidents, and they'd gotten word, the Weilerts, that these people were leaving the state shortly. So what your recourse is, if people aren't going to voluntarily return something, you have to hire a lawyer, file a Rip Levin action, get a court order. Buster and Larry go up there themselves, and they're looking, and this van is piled clear to the rafters, the ceiling, with household effects, furniture, or stuff, and so forth. So they're staring at it, and here comes the woman. And she says, who are you? Larry says, you know very well who we are. We sold you this van, and you have failed to make payments, been involved in an accident, and you're leaving town. We have come to take it back. She says, over my goddamn dead body. And Larry at this point says, a pretty good-sized woman. He says, Buster, grab hold of her. He says, she is dangerous. Now, they all agree that she hit the ground at least 3 times. But they disagreed. She said they kept knocking her down. Buster says that she went down on the ground once when she tore his shirt off of him. Lawrence says when she swung at him with a rock, she swung so hard she fell down and hit the ground. So there's a big argument over that. Now, they all agreed that when finally they hot-wired the car and took off with it, the van, that she held on to the handle for 3 blocks as they drug her. And finally, at 50 miles an hour, she fell off and went to the hospital. Had some pretty good-sized injuries. But here's the classical part of it. He says, Buster, hold on to her. She's dangerous. Buster gets hold of her again. And so Lawrence goes over, manages to get the door open, the sliding door, and he starts throwing things out. Finally, he says he created a V, and as he got down the floorboard, there was a shotgun. And she sees it, and she says, I'm going to take that shotgun and blow your damned heads off. Hold tight to her, Buster. He says, hold tight to her. He says to the jury, he says, I realized that we had to protect ourselves. He says, so I knelt down on the gun with my hands on the back of the front seats. He says, like this. And he proceeds to get up, put his knees on the witness chair, and holding on to the arms. And he says, my legs were sort of sticking out the door. He says, all of a sudden, she broke loose from Buster, and she says she came running over, grabbed me by the ankles, jerked backwards, sucked me out just like a cork coming out of a bottle, whereupon he throws his feet behind him and flops down on the floor in front of the jury box. You know, in a suit, on the floor, cocks his head around, and all the jurors stand up at that point, and they're looking down, and he continues to testify. Lying flat on the floor, in his suit, cocked his head around, looking up, the jurors testified. Now, he testified for another 4 minutes or so. Finally, he ran out and looks to me for the next question. And I'm watching all this, and I try to ask the next question. Nothing comes out. So I take a deep breath. Everybody's looking at it, jury. And I start to ask the next question, and I burst out laughing. I said, oh, God. And the courtroom goes to pieces. Judge goes into hysterics, runs into chambers. The juries are laughing. Crying. Larry is still lying there looking up at the jury, waiting for the next question. And we finally had to have a 15-minute recess for everybody to get under control. I couldn't have asked a question if my life depended on it. It was the funniest damn thing I think I had seen in years. Well, anyway, would you believe it that we won that case? And what's more, they sold all the stuff that was in the van. That's illegal, too, to help defray the payments that they had missed. Well, anyway, that's the wider story.
What year was that?
Oh, God, that must have been 20 or 25 years ago. It was shortly after that that I was at Hayes, Stockton, opening day of term. The regular judge was Ben Burney, Burr haircut. I really love Ben Burney. I thought he's a wonderful judge. Ben, you'd ask him, he'd say, I'm an alcoholic. When's the last time you had anything to drink? 35 years ago. But if I had one drink, I'd be a drunk again. You know? Well, anyway, Ben had this Burr haircut. Everybody has to be, at that time, present for the opening day of term. Your cases are called, all the criminal cases are called, and so forth. And I was up there, and Ben takes a bench, and all of a sudden, he looks back, third row, says, get the sheriff. Sheriff comes in. He says, Sheriff, that man back there in the third row, he says, take him out and get a haircut. He says, can't stand anybody with hair like that in my courtroom. Hair down to his, below his shoulder blades. Sheriff takes the kid out, brings him back. He's got a burr cut just like Ben. Really, he looked better. Ben says, okay. He says, Sheriff, what's this man charged with? Sheriff looking, well, nothing that I know of. Ooh, he says, better get the county attorney. County attorney comes in. What's this man charged with? County attorney says, well, nothing. He says, you? He says, what are you doing in my court? Kid says, I was home from KU for the Easter recess, and one of my political science assignments was to go to court and write a paper about going to court. Ben says, Sheriff, I'll reimburse you the cost. The sheriff said he paid for it himself. Ben says, son, someday you'll thank me for this. Can you imagine the paper he wrote?
Oh, God.
Oh,
went
yeah.
Went to court and got a haircut. Anyway, there were some great judges in those days, and of course, the judge couldn't do that today.
Lee, do you remember the case that you called me there in Oklahoma City about McGinnis, Dalton McGinnis?
Yeah, I remember taking his deposition.
You said you don't remember all the details about it. I remember you called and said, you want to see some fun? I'm going to tear a doctor up. And, you know, Lee was a great one to be real prepared. He knew more about the human body than the doctors did. Mm-hmm. Lots of them, even experts. And he called me, and I said, oh, my gosh, he's my neighbor. My Steve goes with his daughter. He said, well, I'm going to tear him up. And it wasn't Dalton. It was Thurman McGinnis, the one that I was in. But that was funny. Lee had his court reporter. He took a deposition, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I won that case.
Oh, you when you got up, you just tore him apart, and the first thing is McGinnis, when we walked into his clinic, he made Lee sit down and wait till he got through with seeing patients.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, that just infuriated. I could just see if you... And when he started off, he was just as kind as he could be to Dalton McGinnis. And then pretty soon, it was a back injury. The guy was claiming 100% disability and had done so previously. And so he started visiting with the doctor, and he said, Doctor so-and-so and so-and-so. He kind of stumbled. He said, Doctor, let me explain it to you so at least you can understand what's going on. And got pretty mean with him. And finally he just said, is this your writing down here? Yeah, that's this. Is this your nurse? The one is, yeah, that's the same one. And it's exactly, the doctor had exactly...
written the same report.
Written the same, word for word.
We had about 15 of those reports on different patients. He always said the same thing about them. You know, he's lying.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy, I'm trying to think of his name. He's a coroner of Pittsburgh, Duquesne County, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he testifies in the Kennedy assassination and the O.J. deal, and he's always in the news. I see him all the time in the news. Now, this is a very large case, and so I proceed to get all the depositions and transcripts of his court testimony that I could find. I think I read over 100 transcripts of testimony in various cases before I go up to cross-examine him. And the name may pop in my mind here pretty quick. Very famous, but also a damn liar. So I cross-examine him for 8 hours. And he's so goddamn furious. Remember, he's coroner. He's so damn furious that he can't see straight. He can't talk at times. He's so mad. And when we finally finished, he says, I sincerely hope. He says that someday I have the opportunity to examine you in my professional capacity. But what you do is you prepare. And in large cases, the plaintiff attorneys will go to the same guys over and over again who will testify. You know, they can count on them for testifying in their favor. But if you get a bunch of transcripts where they've said the same thing over and over again, a jury's not going to believe them.
Yeah.
And so you prepare yourself. See, most doctors think that they know so much that they don't bother to prepare themselves. And for example, in psychiatric cases, I read all the literature. I read the journal reports, and I've got the facts. And I go to work on the poor guy, and pretty soon he's in big trouble and doesn't know how to get out of it. They are infuriated. Minninger's, we've had all kinds of trouble with Minninger's. You know they're moving to Houston? They're going to be part of Baylor.
Oh, they are?
Moving completely out of Topeka. They've got 1,500 workers in Topeka. But at any rate, there's a guy named Herb Modlin who was the chief of staff, and he calls himself a forensic psychiatrist. And he travels around with a lawyer, professor at KU, who's a psychologist, and they form a team, always testifying for the criminal defendant in criminal cases and for the plaintiff in civil cases. And I'd say in the early 60s, I had my first encounter with him. And so I cut up Modlin bad. And I wrote a law review article about it. Cross-examination psychiatric witness. Well, the next time I come up against him, they read that article and they're prepared to handle what I did in the article, except this time I did it a different way. And that went on back and forth for years. I think the worst thing for him that came in the time of the situation all of you trying a case at Kinsley, Kansas. Now, the plaintiff had volunteered to pour gasoline in Harold Hall. You remember Harold Hall?
Sure.
In his pickup truck. Because he couldn't get it started. Well, while he's pouring gas in the carburetor, Harold cranks it, and there's a big explosion. This guy has horrible burns. But I also found out that he was a drug distributor, corrupting all kinds of young girls, and used drugs. And so the question is, how much of his psychiatric injury was caused by the our accident, and how much by drugs?
Yeah.
It's logical, isn't it? And, of course, that way I could get in the drug issue before the jury. Well, the first, what's his name? The psychologist. Yeah, it's immaterial. But anyway, he's wearing cowboy or snakeskin boots, and he has hair down to his shoulders. And I'm cross-examining him. I ask him the effects of LSD on the human body and mind. Well, he thinks I'm asking about his personal experiences. So he's looking down the floor and kicking, and time passes. And time passes. About 5 minutes goes by, and everybody in the courtroom knew that he thought I was asking about his personal experience. And, of course, you draw it out as long as you can. And after about 5 minutes passed by, I said, oh, I see the problem. I said, you think I'm asking you about your personal experience with the LSD, and that wouldn't be fair. I said, I'm asking about the effects generally Oh, he says, oh, a tester mouse. Okay, now Herb Motlin. He comes on to testify, and I'm cross-examining. And I say, you're familiar with the fact that Noyes and Colbert's a classic psychiatric textbook, states such and such. Yes, Mr. Turner, he says, I agree that it states so and so. He says, but that proposition is in error, and I have so advised the author who agrees with me. So I lay another one on him, same answer. I lay another one, same answer. Finally, I lay another one on Mr. Turner. He says, I don't know how far this has to go. He says, but that is ridiculous, preposterous, and has never had any standing in the psychiatric community. And I said, I presume you've told the author your opinion, and he agrees with you. As a matter of fact, he says, I have. I said, is it a sign of incipient mental illness, sir, when a person begins to talk to himself? Yes, he says, it well may. I said, who is your analyst, sir? I do not have an analyst. I said, I thought you just told the jury it's a sign of incipient mental illness when a person begins to talk to himself. I do not talk to myself. I said, sir, I beg to differ with you, because if you told the author this was asinine, ridiculous, preposterous, and never had any standing in the psychiatric community, you had to be talking to yourself, because you, sir, are the author. And I shoved the paper under his nose, and he looks at it. And guess what he said? A four-letter word. Now, the psychologist, at this case I told you, but I told the jurors what I thought, he shows up to testify in that case. And so he testifies. Now, if you get a jury laughing at a witness, the witness is through. They'll never recover again. So in cross-examination, I said, nice to see you again, sir. Schulman. I said, but you'll have to forgive me, sir, for not recognizing you at first. I said, you've done something with your hair. What he had done, he's afroed it, and he had this big afro. He's a white guy. And, of course, the jury just laughs to beat hell at him, and he's through. Well, anyway, those are, you know, you could spend the next months talking about vignettes of things that have happened in trials.
Lee, I'd like to have you tell about the trial about the gal that had syphilis. Tell us about that. That's funny.
Well, it wasn't syphilis. what had happened at Colby, husband and wife had divorced. They had two kids. This divorce took place. No, it took place at Goodland. The wife moved with the kids to Colby. The husband moved to Burlington, Colorado. Now, every other week, the husband got the kids. The husband remarries, sends the new wife over to pick up the kids. The old wife at Colby's on a Saturday beat the hell out of the new wife. The new wife is crying and bloody and so forth, and she calls her husband. He calls the judge at Burlington. He says, you got to solve it in Kansas. Calls the judge at Colby. He says, you got to go to Goodland where the divorce was granted. So this is on a Saturday. The county attorney, Pete Whalen, is on the golf course. He calls the judge, says, be at the courthouse at 6. And
I was defending the sheriff and the judge, and Heather.
Everybody there at 6 o'clock.
Now, they handle it,
and they like order the woman, has sheriff, who has no jurisdiction,
she tried to go over and get the woman,
have that
and course. Bring her.
Now, her lawyer
courthouse
had a gold cross pen.
Now,
and he would
indicate
to her how she should answer by going like this.
There was no with the pen
authority
for yes
to have something like that.
But the jury saw it.
But nonetheless, they had a hearing.
Didn't bother me a whole
and
but all
the judge
been very careful.
What county attorney says,
our judge was all
Wesley
volunteer.
E. Brown.
He's 95.
Still
she
on
says they ordered her to be there.
Court.
Told
and
me he's going to
put her in jail
him
if she didn't do what they said.
Anyway,
what they said is turn the children over to the husband.
And a martinet.
Well, the sheriff drove to Colby with
and,
the kids.
So on cross
turned him over to the husband.
Said,
the husband took him to Colorado and
kept
this
him
is completely
for the next 2 years.
And so she's mentally shot.
And I said, you told the jury that
and she's suing for $1 million damage
help before
the husband still had the kids. This is not a
problem in the world.
And all these county officials,
no mental judge or defendants.
That's correct. And now look at you.
Yes.
Started crying. I said, ma'am, do you recall seeing Dr. Regeer 2 weeks before this occurred at Colby? Well, yes. I said, do you recall she gave you a complete physical exam? Well, yes. And she told you she thought maybe she'd better draw some blood from you and send it in for analysis? Yes. I said, do you recall that 2 days later she called you into the office and told you she was sorry to inform you that you had, not syphilis, it's the other, gonorrhea. Judge came right up out of his chair. He says, gonorrhea? And I says, yes, Your Honor, in the vernacular. And I said what it was in the vernacular. Gonorrhea, he says, sinks back into his chair. She looks at her lawyer. He doesn't know what the hell to do with his pen. Up or down or sideways, he doesn't know anything. And so finally she looked at me. She says, but it wasn't mine. I said, whose gonorrhea was it, ma'am? She said, it was my sister's. I said, now let me see. Your physical exam, your blood test, and your sister's. I said, ma'am, that's a neat trick. That's all. And of course, she lost the case. That was a funny case.
This concludes part one of Dean Porter's interview with Lee, which they did in the year 2000. Part two of this interview is on CD number 2.